This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
A nation, our world of people who do not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent. Do you fit that category, folks? I certainly hope not, because I believe we can get ourselves out of this situation if we will just open our eyes, our ears, and wake up. Stop believing what you're told and what you read and begin to find the truth for yourself.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A decade of Republican Party policy changes are signed off in 1 week as the searchlights on Trump card Don's high tower swivel away from Russia and turn to point at China. And Hillary Clinton seems to have managed to escape criticism pretty much, as the ruthless Lady Macbeth of the piece, her crooked superdelegates, stole the Democratic nomination from Bernie Sanders, helping Donald Trump to win. Also, the Zionist lobby are preparing to celebrate, poised to tick off point four, nearly two-thirds of the way along their unholy six-point plan for white Europeans to take over the Middle East. The moving of the Israeli capital I'm talking about from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem is step four of these six towards possibly a religious war between Israel and Iran, and Trump wants to do it. We also take another look at evidence for this long-term crusader land grab. Nearly 1,000 years after the medieval First Crusade, and every bit as barbaric, Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu's 1980s book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win, and the infamous Oded Yinon plan to balkanise the Middle East. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, 93.2 at noon every Tuesday this week. We heard a clip from it in the first hour. It's Chris Jones. He's disabled, but they're not paying him any benefits. He lives over in Nelson in Wales. Also, The Level of Revolution, John Rees, who wrote the book, cancelled an interview at the last minute, so we discuss his Levellers book for him. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. You can listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. First, Vary Threlfall's still with us, and I'm also joined by Jackson Moulding from Ecomotive. Hi, Jackson. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Can you just tell us a little bit about Ecomotive? What do you do there?
Well, Ecomotive grew out of the Ashley Vale project in St. Werburgh's, and so we've...
Ashley Vale's quite an amazing place, isn't it? You go under that tunnel in St. Werburgh's. How did that all happen?
Yeah, through past the climate centre, through the graffiti tunnel, and
some
then
fantastic
a haven of a
some fantastic self-designed buildings. How did it? What's the story behind that?
Well, the project evolved because the site came available, and it's a 2-acre site, so it's quite a big site, and the local people living in the neighbouring houses were trying to find a way to give people a chance of having a home that they could afford, and self-build had already been undertaken by a couple of guys nearby, and they were very strong advocates, and they're saying this really needs to be a way. We should be creating homes where we get people involved and get people creating the spaces they want to live in, and actually it's a lot more affordable as well, so you get a whole myriad of wonderful benefits from that sort of project.
Well, I've saw people pricking their ears up when you say it's more affordable, so could it actually be cheaper to build your own home?
It certainly can be, because you can choose the budget. So you take, there's an element of sweat equity, and that's where you put your own hard graft into building. So if you can put more of your own time in, you get some savings there. You also get to save on the potential profit margin that a developer would take away. So there's a couple of areas there, but you can also choose your budget. So if you're, you know, if you're fully loaded with lots of money, you can actually build your grand designs or anything you like. If you've got lower budget, then you can obviously be more scrupulous about the sort of materials and things you use. And if you've got no budget, then there are projects like community land trusts where you can be involved, and then you could end up renting the home afterwards. And the community self-builder agency has been supporting ex-military people into self-finished homes through that mechanism as well.
Yes, I think there's a place up in Bedminster which Knightstone built, which was with ex-servicemen. But Jackson, did you actually build your own place there as well?
Or I did. I was lucky enough to be there at the right time and managed to get enough money from the bank to build a home.
How much did you actually put in money to get people to build it for you? Or were you actually physically putting kind of one brick on top of another yourself?
Yeah, we didn't use many bricks. We built it out of timber. But yeah, did virtually all of it ourselves, me and my partner. And it was, it was a wonderful experience. And actually putting up the timber frame, there's almost nothing better than that. When that goes up and you look up and you think, wow, look, you know, we made a little model originally that was...
So is it still there? How's it getting on, the house?
It's still there. It hasn't creaked over. We're actually right beside the railway line, so as that goes past, you can sort of feel the rumble. But actually, in our place, it holds together really tightly. And actually, timber frame. I've just come back from a research trip in Japan, and where they've got obviously loads of earthquakes all the time, and there is a move towards timber housing, where they used to have actually in the past lots of timber buildings, but then they moved towards concrete. But then all the concrete and the sort of solid built homes sort of crumble with earthquakes. So actually timber houses are, you know, a way, strong houses of the past and strong houses for the future.
Now, in a way, this is a potential way out of this housing crisis, isn't it? Particularly, Vari, when you've got people who maybe have skills in building but don't have work. And I know that in Eastfield there are a few projects actually on the go. So can you just tell us about those?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really interesting. So you can hear the passion in Jackson's voice as he talks about the self-build project. I mean, it's a real example, I think, of the resistance against a very traditional market where you either rent from somebody else, in which case you're indebted to them and their whims, or you are tied to a mortgage and you've got various other issues in terms of buying a property that perhaps doesn't suit your needs for whatever reason. Self-build, I think, is really, really interesting. There's two projects in my ward at the moment. One is through the Bristol Community Land Trust. It's 12 properties, and as Jackson alluded, some of it is self-build, some of it is actually the sort of finishing, and there's a real mix there from studios right through to sort of three-bed houses.
So I think this is the one on, just on the edge of Eastfield Park, as you're going up Fish Ponds Road on the left on Eastfield Park. Just you can see this kind of construction site. How it looks as if it could even be, last time I went past it, it looked like it could be nearly ready soon.
No, it's completed. There's seven units which are there's six three-bed homes which are shared equity, and there's one-bed home which is shared equity, and the other five are rented, affordable rents. So it's fantastic project. And the seven units which are shared equity are sold at 50% market value. So having a home right on the park, it's been fantastic.
Just explain this shared equity thing.
Okay, so shared equity is where you have the opportunity to buy into the home. So if you can raise some finance, you can get a mortgage, but you can't raise potentially the amount that you would need to buy the house at full market value. So if the house has a value of, say, £240,000 on the market, and you go into a shared equity approach with a community land trust or even a housing association, then whatever equity you buy would be the percentage you own. But effectively, it's still your home. You live in it. It's your space. And so if it's a 50% shared equity, you would pay £120,000 for a £240,000 home.
I suppose the big question is, are people being able to be housed there, Vari, off of the housing list? Because we've got this massive, I think last time I looked, it was around about 15,000 people desperate for somewhere to live in the city.
Yeah, so I mean, from that one specifically, I mean, obviously that's people moving into those properties. I mean, the added advantage of that development is, of course, the developments for the community. So they have added a lot back into Eastfield Park. In terms of people moving off the housing waiting homeless, interestingly, and this isn't directly self-build, but links to this idea of the sort of social and environmental considerations when you're thinking about self-build, is what's been happening on the Dunmail site in Southmead. So that's 150 properties that are going to be built on this site, of which 30% are going to be affordable, and there's also going to be social housing in that mix. So they've partnered with United Communities. Now, the organisation behind that, the architecture firm, is HAB Housing, and they're a social enterprise. They've managed to get investment through the Bristol and Bath Regional Capital Fund, and it's very much a really interesting and different way of looking at development, one that is very much got that social mindedness, the environmental considerations. So you're talking about passive house as well, so they're all built to a really high environmental standard.
Okay, what is a passive house? I don't know if I like the sound of a passive house. It sort of just sort of sits there and doesn't really do anything. Mm. I suppose that's actually, maybe that's what you want. But what do you mean by a passive house?
So what it essentially is talking about is actually that it's got sort of high environmental standards, so it will have decent sort of insulation standards. I mean, as a self-builder, you probably could describe
Jackson,
this better.
What Jackson, what is this? What's a passive house? Yeah.
So a passive house is where you've got very, very low energy costs to run the home. I think it's
sounds good. Yeah,
it uses, what's the definite? It's like 15 kilowatts of energy per square meter throughout the year. So it's effectively, you have a very low running cost in terms of heating and hot water is pretty much the same throughout, because you still use the same amount of hot water, but certainly the heat. So it's reduced the amount of heat loss from the fabric of the building, and it tries to capture some of the energy as well.
So you're looking at the sort of internal as well as external modifications in terms of improving the insulation of the property. But Dunmail's a really, really, I think, exciting example of that on a larger site. And then on a smaller site, we've got another example within my ward, which is Bright Green Futures, and they're building 14 units. And what they're doing is really quite interesting in terms of their model, which is crowdfunding. For properties. So they have maybe an identified site, so this one for instance is in Laura Grove Road, and then they have individuals sign up for that piece of land. They co-buy that piece of land, and then they co-build as well, so they're sharing the costs and materials, and they're sharing the costs of the build. So if people have the capacity and the ability to build, they do so. And they're also building in things like carpooling, community centres and cafes, all within the same structure. So it's really fascinating, that model, that actually you could get people who maybe perhaps are complete strangers actually buying in together in order to be able to self-build and build their own home. And this is open to anybody, including those perhaps in the housing register.
Well, I suppose it sort of breaks the market of the developers, because these big house building firms have got almost a virtual monopoly, Jackson, haven't they?
Well, there's certainly a huge growing appetite out in there in terms of people wanting to have some sort of involvement in their future.
We don't
home.
Do this in Britain, do we? I mean, in other countries, I mean, my folks are in New Zealand. Everybody over there, they just build a house, and that's what you do. Well, not everybody, but most people, they will be involved in some way in actually designing that place as well. They say, oh, well, I think, you know, I want the rooms here and there, and you can have something off the peg, just like everyone does here. But and also, the other thing that bothers me about in Britain, the new houses that are being built here, is they seem to be getting smaller and smaller. It's like the ceilings are coming down and down. You know, they've got mirrors in the rooms to make them look bigger.
Well, we've got this interesting thing, isn't it? Where we create houses for profit, then the creation of the housing in itself is almost secondary to the creation of the finance. So if we can get back to the point where we're creating houses to create homes rather than for creating profit, and I think as soon as we put the people in a position where they're influencing what they're going to get, it changes the story. And so there's lots of people that live in very small spaces that are really fantastic, you know, living on canal boats, living in converted vehicles, there's the whole tiny house movement that's growing. There's a strong movement in Bristol that's growing. There's a tiny house movement here. It's sort of come over from America, and there's a lot of people that enjoy and would willingly live in a small space if they had some control over it.
You've got a tiny house movement in Kowloon. I've seen pictures of it in the Daily Mail, where you've got a little box to live in that's hardly just about enough room for you and a fridge.
Well, yeah, so there's a balance here, isn't there? So there's a balance. If there's a top-down approach to creating tiny houses, particularly like by a developer that's creating profit, and they can maximise out a site, get very high density, then that's the that's the kind of the wrong route to creating small spaces. If you've got a sort of a growth from the ground about people going, actually, these are the sort of spaces we're willing to live in. We've got like a community space where we've got like a wider space we can sort of go out and be part of. You've got external space, growing space, social space. Then actually living in a small space, you know, like people love living. You know, there's a very romantic side to living on a canal boat where you've got, you know, you can get out of your boat, you can walk along the canal, you can have that interaction with other people.
Only if it's frozen over.
Well, yeah. Well, not actually on the canal. walking along beside the canal.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the main problem here is that these are only quite small projects, Vary, aren't they, at the moment? I mean, you know, we've got a big, if it is 15,000 still, it may be more. I'm sure it's not less. You know, how are we going to actually make a dent like this?
I think there's a huge possibility, but it needs to be upscaled. And I think what Jackson says is completely right about this idea that as long as you're focused on the bottom line, you're not going to get anywhere towards tackling the housing crisis, but also providing decent affordable accommodation for individuals. I mean, viability studies, if you talk to any councillor, we will bang our heads against the wall if you mention the word viability studies, because that's what a lot of these massive developers are doing in terms of trying to get out of their affordable housing requirements. And it's incredibly frustrating, whereas Bright Green Futures, when their planning application came through, they had their own names. They had names next to each property. This is Steffi's house. This is, you know, X's house. And I think that's quite interesting. And I think it's really very much about disrupting that market and actually changing the way people think about housing in a positive way. And I think that in itself will hopefully enable us to move forward with a lot of the other projects we're planning.
Well, and I think there certainly is a room here for some leadership as well from the local authority. It's fantastic that you're here now speaking about this as a local councillor. We've seen, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, we went on a visit to Almere in Holland, where they've got a scheme of a fantastic scheme of 3,000 self builds on one site. You know, so this is, and Amsterdam has got a flurry of self build and people led housing projects. And those visits, the leader of Teignbridge Council attended, the leader of Cherwell Council attended. Both those local authorities now in the UK are leading the movement around community-led housing and self-build. So now in Cherwell in Oxfordshire, they've got a site of 2,000 custom-built homes. In Teignbridge, they've now got a housing policy that includes that you have to incorporate a number of self-build schemes into any larger development project.
This is really only okay, Jackson, isn't it, if you've got £100,000 at least in your back pocket?
No, not necessarily, because if you recall about 10 minutes ago, I mentioned that the community land trust method is around how we create housing that enables everyone to participate.
Well, that's why I said 100,000. I mean, so the community land trust will have the other half of the shared equity.
No, that's the shared equity element. So there is, there's no reason why through a community land trust model that the community land trust can't actually create the finances to build out, and then those homes are then rented out into long term. Now, creating homes is obviously a complicated process, and there are costs there, and there's borrowing, and there's a reduction in the sort of funding that comes available. Now, the Bristol Community Land Trust that we helped set up about 5 years ago, halfway through the process in Eastfield Park in the Fishponds project, halfway through, the fund for us to receive the funding to enable those houses to be subsidised, suddenly we were told by the Homes and Communities Agency that we needed to become a housing association. It's like, well, yeah, the Bristol Community Land Trust wasn't set up to become a housing association. We already have wonderful and amazing housing associations in Bristol, but suddenly there's this bureaucratic process that the community-led housing movement has to kind of almost conform to meet the kind of requirements to work in this arena. So there's
a whole load of bureaucracy that comes with that, I guess.
There is, and there's trying to find a way through that. And we have, you know, the Fishponds project is virtually completed. The hoarding's still to come down, and that's going to be exciting. The group is that group particularly finished the homes to a self-finished process, so they all were able to acquire extra equity in their homes.
Okay, so that's a kind of halfway house. Oh, gosh, I shouldn't say that, should I? Between self-building and buying a purpose-built house, it's self-finished. What does a house look like when you arrive to self-finish it?
Well, the group, we got the group involved really early on, so actually they were involved before the structure of the buildings went up. But effectively what the group got was they got the shells of the building, they were watertight and secure, and then insides were completely open, so they were able to fit their own kitchens, fit their own flooring, decorate, fit their own tiling. We did get the bathrooms and all the toiletry and the sinks and stuff installed, but effectively those finishes were undertaken by the people coming in. Mm-hmm. And then there's all the external, so all the landscaping, the design of the space outside was all put back into their hands. So the Community Land Trust owns that space, but the group feel, and they feel it is effectively their space. Mm-hmm. And as a group they make the decisions, and they work out how much budget they want to put to different aspects to it. You know, do they want to raise beds? Do they want to, you know, fancy bike parking? Do they want to create sheds? These things are, they can use the budget to work on that. So the self-finished model, it's not just about making a financial benefit, but it's actually about how you bring a group together and create a community through that sense of participation.
I suppose the big question is going to be, can the council help with all this sort of thing, and to what extent they can, Fari?
Absolutely. I mean, there's certain things that we can do.
Obviously, you can help by giving people planning permission. Hmm. That helps.
Sites is the best.
I think it's sites identification. So Dunmail, I mean, I should have said earlier, Dunmail actually is a council site, which is why it's been quite easy to kind of, what I say easy, it's been a long journey, but easier than say if it was a private site. But certainly site identification is one way the council can help. But equally, and I'm sure Paul Smith will be talking more about this, but around us creating our own housing delivery company. So actually how we can support self-build within that, and how we can support self-build in terms of our strategic priorities as well, would be quite an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah, there's loads of people who are really interested in this out there that would maybe like to, you know, especially go and have a look at these existing schemes, and then maybe to sign up to do something in the future. I mean, I can remember years ago talking to a guy called David John from Spring Hill in Stroud, who created their own kind of company to build a co-housing project there, and they ended up finding that once they'd finished building it, that everybody had their own homes there, but they were actually almost on the first day worth almost twice as much as they paid for them. So this is actually, you know, if you just, you could almost spend your life doing this and become a millionaire very quickly by just building great houses and then building another one and then selling the one you've just built. But anyway,
that's a really interesting point, and actually it's used quite often, particularly for the Ashley Vale project. It's like, wow, you know, you guys have gone in there and you've made all these lovely big houses, and now you're all like sitting on this massive wealth. The question is why is that seemed as a, like, firstly that's obviously seen as a negative, but the key thing is these houses are only worth more because there aren't more projects happening around the place. If actually these sort of projects were happening everywhere, then it wouldn't seem so individualist or so separate to everything else. So actually what we need to do is enable and seed projects across the city, across the southwest, which are community led. They're fantastic places to live, and it won't be seen such as a different sort of place.
What about signing up to this? Because I know the council has got a list of some sort of people anyone that's interested in doing self-build. Do you know about that?
Yeah, there's two things here. One is that there's new legislation that's came out last April, which put into place the requirement for every local authority in England to have a register of people who are interested in creating their own homes. Now, some local authorities have still got to get up to speed with that. Bristol holds its own register in-house. There is the local self-build register, which is a national platform that South Gloss and Baines use. And if anyone is interested in building their own place, whether it's through a co-housing or community land trust or other form of community-led housing project, then it's really worth putting your name, contacting the local authority, putting your name on that list, because there is now a requirement for the local authority to provide planning permission for service plots for the number that's equivalent to the number of people that are registered on that list. And so there's a really fantastic opportunity to provide that lever to really encourage the local authority to move in this area. The second thing is, and this is a fantastic move that's come out of central government, and it's taken a long time to bring this forward. We set up the National Customer Self-Build Association back in 2008, and that's been lobbying central government for a long time around this. And there's a community-led housing alliance that's been working more recently around this. But just before Christmas, the government announced £60 million to go out to local authorities across the country to support them to empower more community-led housing projects. Now, that £60 million has been identified to particular local authorities that have already been proactive. Unfortunately, Bristol didn't get any of the first tranche, which is really sad. But it'd be really great if we can get to a position next year when they do the next tranche to get the next £60 million, because it's going to be £60 million a year for the next 5 years. So this is for outreach, for support, for enabling groups and communities to come together and work out what they need to
do. Now, Bristol's got its own list for anyone that's interested in building their own place, but there is a kind of national scheme as well, isn't there?
Well, there's the local self-build register, which is actually enabling, which people can register on, and that their information will be collected and then provided to local authorities that use that platform. But lots of local authorities are using their own platform as well.
And so what do you get if you sign up to that list?
You don't get anything directly. What you're doing is effectively, it's a formal way of having a petition. What you're doing is you're putting your name down to say, I am interested in some time in the future that I would like to be able to build my own place. Even if you're not physically building it, you would like to influence your future home. Mm. And by putting your name on that list, the local authority can see what the demand is, and they have a legislative requirement to make planning permission plots available. Now, it might be that you put your name on the list and you don't get one of those plots, but they have a process. They've just finished the first base period that ran from the 1st of April to the end of October last year, 2016, and they've now got 3 years to provide planning permissions for that number. Now, they're in the second base period, so anyone that's interested should find their local authority.
Is there any sort of networking happening around those people? I mean, are they being invited along to things, say, look, you know, this is a new self-build project that may happen in your area, that kind of thing, or what?
Well, you've got to think, well, who's covering that? You know, local authorities are just trying to get by in the sort of the normal day-to-day.
No, the local authorities won't. No.
Local authorities haven't actually been given any budget to maintain or run this register, so it's actually an additional workload on top of their normal day-to-day.
Which is being cut, of course.
Yeah, so it, you know, it's an additional pressure, and it's understandable. But there's no reason why people can't start proactively maybe trying to set up their own schemes. And, you know, obviously BCFM gets heard all across the country. And so if you're
the
listening
world, excuse
across
me.
The world, yeah, of course. So, you know, it's worth contacting your local authority and finding out if your local authority has been one of the selected 148 local authorities that have got a chunk of the 60 million, and say, you know, what is happening, and most of these local authorities will start outreaching.
And Jackson, where can people go and actually look at places that have already been built? Because I think that's what really inspires you, when you can see a place and think, good God, this is gorgeous.
Well, there's some great projects in Bristol. There's great projects out Bristol. Mm-hmm. We've got the Ashley Vale project is obviously one that anyone can come and walk around, and it's down by the city farm. It's an award-winning city farm, so you can go down and you have some nice bite to eat at lunchtime
that's
on the weekend.
St.
Werburgh's in the heart of Bristol, near IKEA. That's one. There's Stroud Co Housing, which is obviously in Stroud. There's
that Spring Hill, the one I mentioned.
Spring Hill, yep. There's the Leeds Lilac housing project, which I'm not sure actually if they're inviting people to look around yet, because I think they had a bit of
But somewhere you can go for the day, maybe with the kids or whatever, around here, within easy distance, or in Bristol itself?
Well, if you're walking around Eastfield Park, then you can always walk to the top of Eastfield Park, and you can see those buildings that are there from the outside.
You can actually do almost a bit of a journey going from St. Werburgh's up to Eastfield Park and then down towards Grove Road, which is on the other side of Eastfield Park, and see three build projects in one. And what I would recommend as well is that people check out the website. So check out Bristol Community Land Trust website, which details a lot of the process and the history and how they went through that. And also look at Bright Green Futures, because what they do is quite interesting, is that they put up plots of land that they've identified, and you can sign up to or express interest in those sites, and then they go from there, from that point on, in terms of looking at finance. So it's a very interesting model that Bright Green Futures are applying, and I'm sure that could be replicable.
Yeah, and that the Bright Green Futures model is sort of has been used in the Ashley Bale sort of, which is the setup on the same scheme. But we're setting up a through Ecomotive our Snug Home program. So we mentioned earlier like the bureaucracy around trying to get projects happening, and we also recognise the tiny house movement. And what we want to do is try and combine the two. How do we reduce the bureaucracy but get a bit of a fast track approach? So we are now in the process, and we would welcome people to come and get involved. We are going to be setting up a people's factory, so we want to create a self-build experience but within a controlled environment, and we are going to be building these modular housing units using timber, low impact building materials. We are currently looking for a venue within Bristol to have a factory space, but there's a sort of slight catch 22 between having a supply out to where the houses can be built and go out to sites without taking on a big space, because there's obviously quite high rental of a big warehouse.
Now, I can see I'm going to have a lot of work to do on tonight's show page with links to all these various things, particularly to things like Ecomotive. I think I should actually put a map up, shouldn't I, really, of a little your walk, Vari, so people can see whereabouts to go in the city to see this. And it sounds like there's actually quite a lot going on. And also, I'll put a link to the council's register for anyone that's interested, and to your register, the national one as well, Jackson, for anyone that's not actually living in Bristol. So look, I'd just like to thank you both very much for talking about that. Sounds quite exciting. And anyone out there that's interested in building your own home, well, I mean, actually, or even living in a self-designed home, you don't have to take one of these horrible little shoeboxes where you're living in a tiny little room from Persimmon Homes, folks, because we're doing it different in Bristol now. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Yeah,
thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, we've had a week, actually, of these various different things that Donald Trump has been bringing. I think probably the most hypocritical, most horrendous one is the stopping of the... the resumption of the Dakota Pipeline, which all these Native Americans have been protesting about.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things he's done. Obviously, the pressure on US presidents, especially when there's a kind of change of regime, as there has been, is to do everything in the first 100 days, like Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in 1933. And Trump obviously intends to sort of try and achieve as much as he possibly can in the first 100 days.
I said at the top of the hour, didn't I, that this is almost 10 years of Republican policies that they've been building up and building up. And he's basically got a big stack of executive orders. He's signing one, another, another, another. You know, it's just like a whole load of them.
Yeah.
Let's just look at what's happened in the first week. Cutting funding for the Department of Justice Violence Against Women program. He's cutting funding. In fact, he's cutting funding for thousands of things. Certainly scores. A National Endowment for the Arts is being cut. A National Endowment for Humanities. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is also being cut. The Minority Business Development Agency is being cut. Economic Development Administration. The Manufacturing Extension Partnership, I have no idea what that is actually. The Office of the Community Orientated Policing Services, the Legal Services Corporation, well, that helps people who are poor pay for legal help. Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice is being cut. Environmental National Resources Division. So, actually, also a UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is cutting the money for that.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, what the idea is that this is all the waste and bureaucracy, and he's going to get rid of it all, and it's about time to.
On a more sinister note, I mean, he's also, I see, cutting. He's ordered the National Park Service to stop using social media, and that is, I mean, this is just saying you're basically trying to control. Is this a kind of control freakery going on here?
Yeah, well, the National Park Service had said something out of line in relation to the inauguration, I believe, so he's decided to give them a hit just to teach them a lesson.
How would you characterise all this? I mean, it's a massive load of executive orders, and we've got Theresa May with him apparently right now.
Well, I mean, he's let's be clear. I mean, he campaigned on a pretty reactionary programme. and he won the election in the United States, even though he didn't win the majority of the votes. He's trying now to argue
This is a bit sneaky of a thing to say, yeah, because he's having to deal with an electoral college system, and that might mean that he would campaign in one place to win the... I mean, it's not what he said, it's what all presidents do.
Well, indeed, but you can understand that in the United...
Martin, just a minute, it's really splitting hairs to say, oh, he didn't win the majority of the votes. Because every president that tries to get elected knows they've got an electoral college system to get around, so they have to try and get the votes in particular states, because the system isn't exactly, you know, it's not a proper proportional representation system, is it?
It's not even a proper first past the post system, Tony, is it? What it is the American electoral system. And of course in Cuba they have an electoral system and they have elections. But you have to be vetted by the Communist Party before you can stand in those elections. Are those elections free and fair? Well, the audience can make up its own mind. In the United States of America, under a constitution written in the 1770s by wealthy white men who didn't want to give women or blacks, who were slaves, the vote, it was rigged quite deliberately to make sure that's what the Electoral College is there for. It's to make sure that we don't have a purely democratic system.
Fresh from 200 years of genocide, by the way.
Yes, indeed. Now, the fact is that Donald Trump has won under the existing system, as George W. Bush did in 2000. He didn't win a majority of the votes either. Now, people say, yeah, but that's the American system, that's the American way. But you've got to understand that in the rest of the world, in the barrios in Latin America, in the slums in Southeast Asia, in South Africa, they look at that and say, yeah, that's the American system, but that ain't democracy. And there's a real question for Trump of legitimacy. What is your actual mandate for all of this? We know what your views are. We know what you want to do, although it's not clear, actually, whether you do want to go to war with China or not, or whether you really do want to back the Israelis to build more settlements, although you're saying that's what you want. Now, we know what you want. You say you've won the election, that's true, but what legitimacy have you got? Putin has got legitimacy. He got 80% of the vote in the September. His party, United Russia, took, not 80%, it's about 65% of the vote in the September election in Russia, which was hardly reported in the Western media.
I think it was just under 60%.
Yeah, indeed.
Assad did do really well.
Assad got much better. Yeah. So in other words, Trump's problem is that both Putin and Assad have got better electoral mandates than he's got. And that's all that counts. Well, it's all that counts if that's all you're concerned about. But in terms of in terms of your real legitimacy, because if you're going to go to war with countries like Syria and Russia, the question is going to arise: have they got more legitimacy than you? And if they have, they're going to have a big advantage when that battle starts.
What about Theresa?
And it's already started.
Theresa May has got a majority. I believe it's now 11, where 30 of her MPs are facing prosecution for fraud in the 2015's general election.
Now, what percentage of the vote did the Conservative Party get at the general election? 37, was it? If that. But she's got total power. All ministers are appointed by the Prime Minister on the back of 37%. And you know what? People in Scotland and people in Northern Ireland, they don't accept the legitimacy of that either. And the people in Northern Ireland so far don't accept the legitimacy of it that they fought a civil war in which 3,000 plus people died. And the British Army, as we know from recent revelations, were involved in hundreds of murders because there was no legitimacy to the system. Now, the problem for Trump is, if you push a hardline agenda, which you are pushing, when you've actually not got a mandate for it, you could provoke a civil war in a country where, as we all know, everybody's got automatic weapons. And if people don't think that in 4 years' time, after an economic collapse, there couldn't be a civil war in America, they need to have a word with themselves, because it's quite possible. Much less likely in Russia. Much less likely.
Okay,
they've got real consensus.
Let's have a look at 12. This is PBS NewsHour's 12 executive actions Trump has signed just in the first week. The border wall. He says it's the policy of the US to immediately construct a wall for the southern border. Had a bit of a row with the Mexicans the last couple of days over this, and Mexicans have cancelled a visit because he says he's going to try and get the Mexicans to pay. Well, of course, actually, what he said about that is that he's going to put a 20% tax on everything from Mexico coming into the US and use that to pay for the wall.
Well, what the Mexican foreign minister said, what that means is that effectively the US consumers will find that the stuff they buy from Mexico is 20% more expensive, they're going to pay for the wall. And don't forget that we're also put 20% tariffs on your imports to us. So people are going to lose. It's when you threaten trade retaliation, you could find that other people are going to, you know, it's going to be reciprocal, isn't it? Other people are going to put up barriers to your stuff. Now, that's a lose-lose scenario for everybody. But there's no reason why the Mexicans are going to say, you're going to export to us, but you're going to put a 20% tariff on our exports, but we're going to not put tariffs
there's
on
also,
your exports.
Martin, there's also a massive increase in deportations, apparently. Trump has prioritised 7 groups of people. Anyone convicted of a crime, charged with a crime, who's committed a chargeable offence, misrepresented themselves to the government, has abused a welfare programme, who is under deportation order, may, in the judgment of an immigration officer, otherwise pose a risk to public safety or national security. And apparently he's going to hire 10,000 more. He is in the process of hiring 10,000 new immigration and customs enforcement agents.
I'll tell you what he won't be doing is in hiring more tax collection people, will he? Because he's going to cut taxes. And therefore, so he's going to waste taxpayers' money on deporting people who are possibly working and paying taxes, but he's going to ease up and cut funding on things like collecting taxes. Because, hey, we all know he's not put his tax return in the public domain, even though he said he would. And do you know why? Because he hasn't paid any taxes for years. That's why.
He's also reviewing, he says, manufacturing regulations, and that is effectively deregulation of manufacturing processes.
Yep.
So the manufacturers can pretty much do what they want, use all sorts of, cut safety, I suppose that's largely about, isn't it? He's also saying that American steel must be put in all pipelines, and also speeding up environmental reviews for all priority infrastructure. So that's to say that, you know, if there's going to be infrastructure going in, they're going to do a very, very fast track looking at the environment thing, and probably won't. But the most important I mentioned earlier was this speeding up the approval of a Dakota Access and Keystone oil pipelines, which has really annoyed Native Americans.
Well, yeah, I mean, that, of course, as you mentioned earlier, Alex Jones, one of the big supporters of Trump, has been opposing this pipeline, and now his great hero is going to support it. And various other people have been involved in various campaigns, which Trump has, they look to Trump to help them. And in actual fact, he's going to do exactly what his corporate backers tell him to do.
Okay, also a federal hiring freeze. The president has told all agencies they're not allowed to fill any vacant positions nor open any new ones.
Yeah, well, a lot of this stuff is very much rocking the boat. He could start a trade war with China. Don't forget, if you say all steel in pipelines in America has to come from America, then the Chinese are going to turn round and say, right, all steel in China has to come from China. And we, when we're doing a deal with him, as Theresa May is doing this afternoon, we might say, no, we're not having any American steel being used in Britain. It's got to be British steel, because everybody's going to have the same policy as you, Donald. Britain first, China first.
I mean, isn't Theresa May there really just as a vassal? Isn't Britain a vassal of the American Empire?
She's in a weak position at the moment because she needs a deal with the US because of the swift Brexit she's going for. And of course, in that position, the deal you are going to get from Trump is rubbish. I think that if we're going to have Brexit, we need to go back to WTO rules.
We do forget this.
There's no point doing deals
Theresa
with the Americans.
Theresa May's husband, Philip, is a manager of a massive US LA-based investment firm.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, the question for Theresa May, who's demanding sovereignty back from Brussels, are we going to get our sovereignty back from Brussels and hand it straight away to Donald Trump? I'm not prepared to sign. I would hope the Parliament will not sign any deal with the US until we know what's in it. Trump's position, which as we know is so nationalistic, it's unlikely that we're ever going to find common ground with him on such a deal. So what are we talking about having a deal with him for? It's ridiculous.
He's pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership too as well, which was actually quite a nasty looking trade deal, which meant that you'd be able to have courts suing governments if they enacted laws.
What do you think Trump's going to demand of the British if they want a trade deal? He's going to want US corporations to be able to sue the British government if they're not happy with what they do. Fascinatingly enough, Australia and New Zealand have suggested that the Trans-Pacific Partnership could be resurrected with China in the place of America. And of course, the whole point of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal was to shut the Chinese out of the Southeast Asian market. So in other words, he might have shot himself in the foot there, because everybody in Southeast Asia may say, oh, that's all dead then, so we'll all have to do a deal with China. Meanwhile, you can put up tariffs against our exports, but we're going to put up tariffs against your exports. Tariffs against American exports to Australia, New Zealand, China, everywhere else. We're going to go for a trade war. Now, what Trump's got to realise is that with the weak US economy, as it has been hollowed out by years of deindustrialisation, it could well be that a full-on trade war with the Chinese, who are actually cutting edge on many things, you're going to lose that trade war. It's not going to be a plus. It's going to be a loss for you.
I mean,
but hey, let's go down that road and find out what happens.
We had the Saker on last week, this former UN military analyst. One of the things he says is that actually economic warfare is a large part of modern warfare.
Absolutely.
And it's, I think he said it was 80% information warfare, 15% economic warfare, and only 5% shooting wars.
Indeed. And therefore, if I was Trump, which I'm not, even if I wanted to carry through a nationalistic policy, I would keep it quiet, because therefore you might be able to persuade people to go along with what you're doing without frightening them. But if you're going to be bombastic about it, I mean, the Mexican response to 20% tariffs on their exports is going to be quite simple. It'll be a 25% tariff on US exports to Mexico. And let's see who loses the most jobs here.
Okay, well, let's have a look at the foreign policy, and picked up a great little piece from, I thought it was good anyway, it was on Press TV, which of course is banned here in Britain by Ofcom, that's the Iranian state broadcaster, and we had on there just yesterday a chap called Keith Preston. He's an analyst from a US website and think tank called attackthesystem.com. Now, I'm sure that comes in those fake news lists that the CIA put out and the BBC put out. But let's have a listen to what he's got to say, because I think he made quite a lot of sense.
It's interesting to observe what Trump has done over the past few days since he's assumed office, and that he is going to follow through with many things he said he was going to do on the campaign trail. Primarily what he's aiming to do right now is to establish his own credibility, to show that he was serious about the things that he said he wanted to do, including enacting a more restrictive immigration policy in terms of building the wall along the Mexican border, reducing the visas that are issued to travelers or migrants from particular countries, and I think that it's interesting to look into how this fits into Trump's overall foreign policy outlook. On one hand, Trump gave a speech back on December 1st in Cincinnati, Ohio, where he said that the United States was going to pull back from interventionism in the affairs of other countries and develop a more a non-interventionist foreign policy paradigm, and instead focus on fighting terrorism committed by the Daesh and groups like that. On the other hand, though, there was an interesting article by Pete Escobar in the South China Morning News yesterday outlining what seems to be the foreign policy paradigm that Trump is pursuing, and it seems to be a foreign policy paradigm that's been developed by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is associated with Henry Kissinger, a longstanding veteran American diplomat. And it looks like that what the American foreign policy under Trump is going to be is something that's going to involve moving the United States closer to Russia, and in the process trying to move Russia away from China and Iran. Because of the actions of the last two American presidential administrations, the Obama administration and the Bush administration, as a result of the very aggressive militaristic foreign policy that the United States has pursued under those two administrations, Russia has certainly moved closer to China and to Iran as well. Certainly, Russia and China now have formed the BRICS trade bloc. Russia has moved closer to Iran over the war against the Daesh. So I think that the particular wing of the foreign policy establishment that Trump represents, or the American elite that Trump represents, is trying to move Russia away from this. I think they see it as a concerning issue from the point of view of American foreign policy interests that the BRIC alliance and the Shia crescent in the Middle East are moving closer together, and I think they want to create a greater wedge between Russia and China and between Russia and Iran. So I think that's the general foreign policy approach that we're going to see with Donald Trump's administration. On one hand, he's going to be more hawkish on China and Iran, more dovish on Russia, with the particular goal of disrupting that triangle that's developed.
Yeah, and it's a pretty delusionary policy, because Russia is the Russians will be foolish to take Trump at his word. One of the things Trump said in a throwaway remark this week, that he's definitely going to create safe zones for refugees in Syria, because he's banning Syrian refugees from the US largely, and he's criticised Angela Merkel for opening the doors of Germany to them, and he's saying the way of solving this is solve problem number one, well, we're going to create safe areas inside Syria. Now, the reason why they haven't created safe areas inside Syria is because the Pentagon, Dunford and various other people have made it absolutely clear, well, the only way we can do that is if we go to war with the Syrian Air Force and the Russian Air Force. We'll have to shoot all their planes down and knock out all of their anti-aircraft stuff before we can create a safe zone. And that's just not on unless we're going to have an all-out war with Syria and Russia. Now, it strikes me as very odd that he should have mentioned this stuff and that he doesn't really understand the implication. But the Russians will be drawing the relevant conclusions. They know that Trump, despite his noises in their direction, is a joker, just like most of the other people who run the United States.
Okay,
of
America. What about this whole thing, though, of possibly wanting to confront China as a way of, I suppose, dealing with them before he deals with the Russians, maybe? And also, I suppose, the big fear of the US, and then this article is excellent that this chap mentioned. I've just brought it up here. It's in the South China Morning Post.
It's Pepe Escobar,
It's Trump will try to smash the China-Russia-Iran triangle, and here's why he will fail, by Pepe Escobar. It's Iran and Russia that is the real problem for the US military, in the an alliance between these two. And, of course, the Russians have been using, at certain points, the Iranian air bases to attack. This alliance between Russia and Iran is the thing that they're going to. They looks as if this is what seems to be happening. Is that they're trying to take the focus off of Russia, so that will hopefully split those two countries. And this is a kind of divide and rule tactic, so they can pick off Iran.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact is that they're having this debate about which country are we going to attack first in public. And of course, the Russian general staff, the Chinese general staff, and the Iranian general staff, who are all on a war footing, they just think, well, okay, you can say that, but we're not going to accept it. He's also supporting the Israelis, who may invade Lebanon sometime soon with his support. They will come into direct conflict with the Syrian army and with the Russian Air Force
also,
if they do that.
Trump is saying apparently it's too early to decide whether to move the US embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, although this is one of his election promises.
Ah, well, he's suddenly started to stub his toe up against reality, which is that nobody says that apart from you. And if you do say that, then you've got no influence in various parts of the world. You know, he's got a list of things he wants to do, but of course they're all contradictory things. So if he does one of them, it actually messes up another of the things he wants to do.
Well, as I mentioned,
which suggests that he hasn't thought any of it through, doesn't it?
As I mentioned at the top of the hour, this is step four. Stephen Sizer, the vicar from London, has pointed this out, who's studied Zionism and written about it, on the Zionist plan to really just simply take over the Middle East. And so this is what Stephen Sizer had to say back in 2008 about this whole idea of moving the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
I want to highlight six ways in which Christian Zionists are applying their faith politically. One, defending Israel. Two, assisting Jewish emigration. Three, supporting the illegal settlements. Four, lobbying for an exclusive Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And five, funding the rebuilding of the Jewish temple. Six, opposing the peace process. I'm going to show you these six strategies are exacerbating tensions in the Middle East, and they are hastening Armageddon. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. forth Jerusalem, lobbying for international recognition. At the core of the Christian Zionist support for Israel's claim to the occupied territories lies the conviction that Jerusalem must remain exclusively and undivided the Israeli capital. If you know your geography, you will know that there are no embassies in Jerusalem. The international community does not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, notwithstanding Marks and Spencer's Atlas, which shows Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So the Christian Zionist lobby is seeking to change world opinion and facilitate Jerusalem becoming the capital of Israel. How are they going to do that? Very easy. You need $100 million and one bill through the through the U.S. Congress to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That's all it will take. In 1995, Senator Bob Dole, who led the crusade to achieve this, said, "Israel's capital is not on the table of the peace process. Moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem does nothing to prejudice the outcome of any future negotiation." That's pretty Orwellian in its logic. It's entirely opposite. It prejudices everything because it destroys an independent, viable, contiguous Palestinian state. If you take Jerusalem out of the ingredients, there is no Palestine. Senator Bob Dole went on to say, "Jerusalem is today, as it has always been for 3,000 years, the heart and soul of the Jewish people. It is also and should remain forever the eternal undivided capital of the State of Israel. The time has come to enact legislation to get the job done." Three occasions, Congress has passed legislation to do that. Three times, successive U.S. presidents have refused to sign off on the legislation. But it's a question of when it will happen, not whether. Give you an insight. The International Christian Embassy sponsoring adverts in the New York Times called Christians to support a united Jerusalem. United meaning exclusively Israeli, not united in the way we would understand. "We, the undersigned Christian spiritual leaders communicating weekly to more than 100 million Christian Americans, are proud to join together in supporting the continued sovereignty of the State of Israel over the Holy City of Jerusalem. We believe Jerusalem, any portion of it, should not be negotiable in the peace process. Jerusalem must remain undivided as the eternal capital of the Jewish people." You hear this mantra all the time, but notice how they end their advert. "Join us in our holy mission to ensure Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel." Moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem is a holy mission.
And Donald Trump apparently is on it, Martin.
Except that he's about to back down because he's suddenly realised that he's escalating and he doesn't know what the end of it's going to be.
Also, there's this massive settlement programme just started. That will help things in East Jerusalem, won't it?
No, it won't. And, of course, if he keeps pushing this pro-Israeli line, he's going to come into conflict with the Syrians and the Russians. So he's not making peace with them either.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Cabinet Member for... This no, actually, no, it wasn't a Cabinet Member at all. It was Vari Threlf, also to Jackson Moulding. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.